Hey, welcome to the Chess Experience. On this show, it's all about helping adult improvers. I want to make learning chess easier for you to navigate, and I also want you to have a more fun experience along the way. I'm your host, Daniel Lona, a fellow chess amateur. Let's get to it. This show is sponsored by Chess.com, the world's largest chess community. And there's a really exciting and new release from Chess.com that I've enjoyed using. It's called Classroom. This feature allows you to easily go over a game live with a friend or a club member that you just played. And you can do so interactively on the board with both of you on video talking to each other. It's also a great way to have a lesson between a student and a coach. And you can check that out on chess.com/classroom. Welcome to this week's show. In this episode, we're featuring one of the most accomplished women chess players from Britain, woman international master, Natasha Regan. Competitively, Natasha has represented England in 2 chess Olympiads. She's also co-written 2 books with Grandmaster Matthew Sadler. One of those books is titled Chess for Life, which addresses how several top players and amateurs deal with maintaining their skills later in life, a topic we'll discuss in this episode. The other book she co-wrote with Matthew is the award-winning Game Changer, which analyzed AlphaZero's games with Stockfish. It offered amazing insights into those games and what we can learn about chess from AI. Natasha has also recently co-presented several chessable courses on strategy, which we'll be discussing in this episode. And just for a little more background on Natasha, she's also earned a degree in mathematics from Cambridge University, has had a career as a professional actuary, and is also an accomplished Go player. In this episode, we cover mostly 2 broad topics. The first is on aging and chess. We dive into her book on that subject, and she offers a few specific strategies for countering some of aging's negative effects on our chess. The other topic includes discussing her 2 most recent chessable courses on counterattacking and intermediate moves, along with some tips from each one. There are links in the show notes to all of Natasha's books and courses that we discuss, and even those that we don't discuss, and I recommend checking them out because her works are superb. Here's my interview with Natasha. I hope you enjoy it. Hi, Natasha. How are you today?
I'm very well. Thank you, Daniel. How are you?
I'm excellent. I'm happy to be talking with you. I'm very excited about this. You know, it's interesting. I want to talk just for a brief moment how this interview came to be, which is that we were already connected on Twitter, but we hadn't interacted much. But Chessable has been doing these great bios of players. They, you know, like long thread bios for people who aren't familiar with it about different players. And they did one for you. And I read through all of it and it was amazing. I was so impressed with what you accomplish and the scope of what you've accomplished, both in chess and outside of chess. And even though I was connected to you on Twitter, I didn't realize your chess resume, so to speak, was that impressive and exciting. And so as soon as I read it, I just knew I absolutely wanted to have you on the show to talk about all that you've done. So that's how it came to be. And so that's why I'm really happy to be chatting with you today.
Oh, well, thank you very much for that. That's very kind. And also thanks to Chessable. It's, I don't actually know who in Chessable put the bios together, but they've obviously done their research and it was really, really nice.
Yeah. Did they consult with you at all on like what to include?
I just saw it. Yeah.
Well, it's great that they do that, and I'm happy they did. So yeah, there's a lot to talk about with all that you've done, Natasha. In fact, it's hard to contain it all into about an hour, but we'll do our best here. What I'd like to start with, though, is something that I think will appeal to a lot of my adult improver audience, which is the fact that you've competed and done very well in senior competitions. And these include events like the World Senior Team Chess Championships and the European Senior Team Chess Championships. In fact, in 2 years ago, in the 2022 World Team Championships, you were part of the women's team that won the entire event. So I think that's all fantastic and exciting. Can you talk about just your general interest in these senior events, and then maybe after that, a bit about that 2022 win?
Yeah, sure. So senior chess, there's sort of a mixed, people have mixed opinions on senior chess. Some players don't like to admit they've reached the age of 50. So 50 is the chess age for becoming a senior. And many players, they say, I don't really want to play seniors. I'm still too young for that at 50. Because you still feel quite young at 50, to be honest.
Sure.
But actually, I thought when I got to 50, I thought it would be really, really fun to play in the senior events. What we've got in England at the moment, and maybe you've got it in the States too, is a generation of players reaching about this age because there was a huge boom in chess in the 1970s, which was just after Bobby Fischer was winning the world championship. That's why I'm saying you maybe have it in the States as well. And so we had a huge explosion of players, a big tournament circuit. And so a lot of players now are reaching about that age, 50, between 50 and 60, we've got many, many players. And so this makes our senior events really lovely. When we go off and play in teams, we've been getting squads of like 30 or 40 players. And so you might get four players in a team or five players and four play any day. But it's just really, really nice that you can kind of hang out with other players that you've known for years, because of course we're all of a certain experience, and so you kind of see the same players again and again in tournaments. But actually, some of the players have been playing throughout. Some players have taken a big break and then are coming back to chess. And I've been lucky enough in my chess career also to play internationally quite a lot. And so it's not just going with the English chess players, but actually you see some of the players from all around the world that you maybe saw in junior tournaments, and then you meet up with them again as seniors, and you kind of pick up conversations just where you left off. So it's like a really nice atmosphere to play in these events. I'd kind of heard about them well before turning 50. Like there was an English player called Keith Arkell who became a senior champion. I think he was European champion, and he just kind of felt like he had a new lease of life when he reached 50, because he could start playing in these events. And yeah, it's really funny because you kind of the first one I went to, I turned up and I felt like I was probably one of the youngest players in the room, and so you feel like you're really young, like a junior again. So it's really nice.
That's great. I appreciate, you know, how you highlighted the sort of the generational appeal of that, of being people who've come from, I guess maybe broadly just what era you lived in, but also sort of a chess generation too, from that experience. I hadn't really thought about that as much, and that there was, you know, like a larger amount of people, you know, sort of in this age category because they were there for that chess boom in the 70s. That's really fascinating. Yeah. I mean, there's like two standout reasons to play in a senior championship. One would be, like you just highlighted, sort of that generational camaraderie, which is really nice. Another could be the chess itself, which is where you're facing people who have sort of the same set of strengths and weaknesses, chess-wise. Yeah. So do you find that as part of the appeal at all too, or is it more just sort of the cultural, social aspect of it that appeals to you?
Well, it's actually, you kind of, before you get to this age, you kind of think it's going to be easier, chess. Actually, I played in the English championships, the English senior championships, for the last couple of years, but it's not easy at all. There's lots of strong players at this age. Now, is the style of chess different? That's a kind of interesting question. I think I feel like maybe that the openings aren't quite as important, and maybe the games, like, you can get you maybe get pieces exchanged earlier and that sort of thing, but not always, right? That you still get some very attacking chess in the senior circuit. So I wouldn't say it's completely different style of chess. Just another thing on the camaraderie though, like in these events, quite often when I'm playing in normal events, you finish the game, shake hands, and that's kind of it. What we were doing in the seniors was all the players were analysing their games after the event. And I think maybe it's a little less sort of fiercely competitive. It's still competitive. But people are sort of happy to share what they thought of the openings and kind of discuss with their opponents after. So we would discuss with our opponents and then also go through the games in the team afterwards and come up with different ideas for our teammates as well. So yeah, it was very, very nice like that. The other thing is, of course, is just traveling to play and going to a nice location. So the one in 2022, we went to Italy. We went to a town called Acqua Terme. And it was really, really nice. Italian food and like walking around the town and seeing the culture there was very nice.
You know, just a little bit more on the chess itself, although I'm happy to hear that people are tend to be a bit more friendly after the game afterwards and interacting with each other. That sounds fantastic. But as for the chess itself, when you prepare for one of these senior events, do you prepare any differently than if, you know, there was no age criteria to the event that you're going to?
How I prepare? So I like to make sure I prepare a lot of tactics before the event, because it gets me sharp and gets me playing a lot more fluently at the board. Now, I do that for both senior events and events against all ages, really. But what I'll make sure I do is for the time leading up to the tournament, so at least a week, but really, you know, thinking a month before the tournament, to try and do, I like to do the puzzle rush on chess.com, the survival puzzle rush. So not the fast one, but just the one where you've got as much time as you like, but you have to solve the puzzles and you're allowed 3 mistakes. I mean, it can take 2 hours to do a puzzle rush, so it's quite, no, it can, because you have to, like, when the puzzles start getting hard, then you think for a while and so it does take a while to do it, but I find it really, really helps in being sharp at the board. In terms of openings, I think I would typically prepare my own openings. So you do get a little bit, you can kind of see what the opposing teams are going to be in advance. But like, say you're going to be on board 3 or 4, you could try and prepare against particular opponents for boards 3 and 4 in advance of the event. I wouldn't typically do that. I'm more kind of prepping my own openings. And so I'll try and make sure I'm up to date. And how I like to do it is to focus on one particular opening before a tournament. I mean, cause I don't have like bags of time to prep normally, so I'm normally kind of working right up to the day before the event and then flying out in the evening and playing the next day and all this sort of thing, so it's not like I've got weeks of prep time. So what I try and do is make sure I'm up to speed with all my openings to a reasonable level, so I've got them kind of in chessable, and I try and train that way, make sure like all my openings are reasonable. And then if I can, I try and learn either one new opening or focus on one particular opening. And I find that way I can kind of build up my repertoire over time. And it's always nice to have like one opening to look forward to. So you might get it in the game or you might not. It depends on what they play. But if there's something, it sort of gives you a little bit of extra excitement at the board that you might get this new opening that you've hardly played before. And even if you don't know it inside out, I find that still works quite well, because you're really engaged with the game and really thinking if you're playing something new. And even if you don't know all the moves, it could be just because you're putting in that extra effort and you've got that little extra buzz about the game because you're trying a new opening. That still, you know, even if it goes a bit wrong, I normally find it just sort of a bit funny when things go wrong. I try not to get upset with myself, but just sort of find it funny. And then what can I do about this position? And try and make the best of that position. And so I find actually if I've got one new opening, then that puts me in a good place for the tournament. But then depending on what they play, I get a chance to play it or not.
Yeah, I love that. That's a great idea to incorporate one new opening at an event that you can potentially try out and give the experience a little bit of excitement and newness. I really like that. I haven't heard that concept before, but that's one I may incorporate myself. I like that a lot. One other question for you about your preparation. You know, you talked about the openings and tactics. Sounds like those are the two main areas you focus on. At this point, are you focused more on staying sharp with those two areas, or are you also looking to improve any particular areas of your game at this point?
Yeah. Now, I would like to improve, and we'll come on to it a little bit later. There's a course I was working on quite recently on Zwischenzugs, and so kind of prepping on those on a particular feature. So I found by writing a course, then I'm staying sharp and doing some chess every day. So I travel into London maybe two or three times a week for work, and the other times work from home. But when I'm in the train, it's about a 45 minute train journey to the office and then 45 minutes back. And that train time, I will spend pretty much all doing chess. And so then that's when I get my chessable up to date, learn all my openings. And then I am trying to gradually add, as I say, either add in an opening, but actually at the moment it's going very, very slowly, but I'm trying to add a bit in end games. And so I'm doing that, you know, the 100 end games you have to learn. Yeah. So I'm only at the basic stages. You would think I would know it all. And I think at one point I did. But
yeah, it's interesting because I'm sorry. I was just going to throw in. Yeah, I was just going to throw in. Yeah, it's interesting because my coach, Andres Toth, he recommended that book to me as well. So it's interesting to hear you dive into it.
No, it's funny. I mean, there's some. It's a mixture of levels, right? Because it does some simple endings and then goes up to quite complex endings. But I was just looking the last few days at the knight and pawn endings, and it's just really, really nice. There's this one about like your knight stopping the rook's pawn, and you put your knight onto g3 to block. So if there's a pawn on h2 trying to queen, you put your knight onto g3, and it creates this L, that like a barrier that the king can't go past. And so if it goes to any of those squares, you fork the king and pawn, and it's how to get a draw. But it's just these kind of geometry things on the chessboard that you wouldn't really notice. But once you know the technique is there, it's just sort of really nice. So it's the ones where I think they just coloured some of the squares in, and you just suddenly, you'd never really thought of it like that, and then suddenly you see it. And I just really enjoy that sort of thing. But who knows if I'll ever get a knight against a pawn opening. I did once get a bishop against a knight, a bishop and knight against a king opening. I got it as a junior actually, but in a world championship. And we had, our coach was David Norwood, grandmaster. In those days, I don't know whether you'd even have ever done this, but in those days we used to adjourn the game. So it'd get to a certain amount of time, and that was the end of the playing session. So you put the move in the envelope and then you resume the next day. And I had bishop and knight. Opponent just had a pawn. It was World Junior Girls Under 20s in Chile, I think it was. Anyway, so I see all this move, and we both know I'm going to be able to take a pawn. It's going to go in bishop and knight against king. Anyway, so Dave, my coach, I come away from the board, and he's like, "You know how to win this, don't you?" And he said, "I can't imagine you'd be playing for England if you didn't know how to win this." And he's like funny. He always is a funny guy. And I suddenly realized, hang on a minute, you don't know how to win it either, do you? And none of our team, like the coach, grandmaster coach, and me, and also the other player in the boys' event, none of us knew how to do it. So we had to ask like all the opposing teams. And I worked out how to do it with the cage and the W and how to do this bishop and knight. And I'd got it all practiced and I knew how to do it. But then my coach went one step further, and he took my opponent out to dinner. and persuaded her that I knew how to do it. And so she resigned the game without me having to ever prove it.
Oh, did you feel a little disappointed that you didn't get to, you know, execute what you had learned?
The funny thing was, I was actually quite relieved because then we still had to play another game later in the day. So it was quite good to just sort of conserve energy a bit. But then, like, years later, my son started playing chess. And I showed him this about the bishop and knight and how to checkmate. And he just loved it. And he used to play just against a very kind of weak computer and just play it again and again. But every time he got a chance to go into an endgame, he wouldn't promote to a queen. He'd always promote to a bishop or a knight and then just like checkmate with the bishop and knight just for fun.
Wow. That's impressive. Most people try to avoid it. So yeah, I want to talk about some of the works, at least that you have done, Natasha. All of them are impressive, but I think one that's particularly relevant for my audience of adult club players is your book, Chess for Life. And just for brief background for people who aren't familiar with it, in 2016, you co-authored this book with Grandmaster Matthew Sadler. The book focuses on how to be successful in chess as you get older and the experiences of a variety of players that you interview discussing this subject. Can you start by sharing how you came to write this book with Matthew?
Yeah, for sure. It came out, I mean, I've known Matthew for many years, and it came out of conversations. We found we and lots of players were often having the same conversation. You'd go to the bar after the games, and the players would be saying, "Oh, it's so tough playing against all these junior players." And this was a very common theme. And Matthew was like, "Well, yeah, but actually we've got more experience as an older player, and there must be a way." It's partly attitude and partly kind of the juniors are really strong. We had both actually happened to watch this film Moneyball. I don't know if you are familiar with the film Moneyball. And that's about, isn't it, baseball, and people use stats in order to kind of predict about which players should be put in a team. And what we were talking about was whether we could use kind of stats from chess space to kind of see how people's play changes over time or what happens over a lifetime of playing chess. I think we didn't get really, really far down that route, but we did get some way down that route of looking at people's games kind of over their career and see what's different. So we did sort of an analysis of, we looked at how people's ratings change over time, and then we looked at how their openings progress over time. We had this thing, we did like a blunder check. So we kind of automated, we put the games through a computer and automated the computer evaluation after each move and looked at whether you're doing well in the openings or the middle games and end games, all this kind of stuff. So we did a little bit of research in the background. But what we also wanted to do was just talk to players and see how they thought about the game differently, things they'd learnt over their careers, because there's like a lot of great, we spoke to a lot of great players, and it was just really, really interesting to see how their outlook on chess had changed over time. So we did interviews with players like John Spielman, Pierre Kramling, Judith Polgar, Sergei Tivyakov, and then so really top players, and also sort of lower rated players who might have had a break from playing chess. And so there was this very interesting guy, Terry Chapman, who had played chess as a teenager. Then he stopped while he set up his own company, was a very, very successful businessman. Then he sold his company and he started playing chess again. And he talked to us about his approach to playing chess and how he had a very structured training program of how he would get stronger. So he wanted to improve his rating like while he was in his 50s. And actually he did. He became a FIDE master. And so he had very like studied the openings, the end games, time management, getting fit, all the different aspects you could think of, chess psychology, and practice games against what he did was practice games against a simulated player. And what they would do, they would both kind of pick an opening and then play study games, you know, practice games against in that particular opening. And they're both learning it at the same time. And he improved a lot at that age. And he still plays, he plays some of the senior teams events and has been doing very well in those as well. So it's sort of how to, and there's some tips in there about how to like extend your chess playing career, or how to you might want to change your style or look at your openings, and also what to think about even choosing which events. What we found was that lots of the players, as they become senior, they want to go to places, they want to, you know, nice places. So instead of when you're a junior, you just want to find the strongest chess that's being played and turn up in a, I don't know, a scout hut or whatever it is. It doesn't matter what the environment's like or who's there, as long as you've got the chess is the absolute focal point. And what we found was as players got older, that actually they would, if they felt like they were having a nice time and they were in a place they wanted to be with people they wanted to be with, they said that they felt better able to play and just played better chess. So it's sort of how to pick your tournaments. The other sort of slightly surprising thing, I don't know, before we wrote the book, we were thinking that older players would want slower games. But actually, most of them were commenting just the other way around, that actually they don't want a six-hour game. They want, you know, half hour each, an hour each. That's plenty. And actually, rapid play games are a kind of ideal because you can kind of use your experience in a rapid play game to play decent moves. But actually, you, like as an older player, it's sometimes you might feel tired by the end of a six-hour game. Or just talking personally, it's not even necessarily that. It's just that I don't want to spend 6 hours on one game. If I want to play 6 hours of chess, I'd probably play three or four games in that time. And right. And that's kind of how I prefer to play nowadays.
Well, that makes sense, and that actually brings up a question that I wanted to discuss with you. And you touched on this already a little bit and how you've sort of set the stage for this book and the players' experiences. But I'm curious, like, as you interviewed all these people, if certain challenges that they identified kept coming up repeatedly, like, you know, common challenges that these players faced as they got older, specifically related to getting older. And it sounds like energy for long games is one of them that we just discussed. What others did you find?
A couple of other. So there's advantages and disadvantages, right? But a couple of the disadvantages, I think there's a few. So one is making blunders and calculation. So Terry, who I mentioned just before, he said that he'd be playing a great game. He'd have, you know, prepped all morning, playing a great game, and then occasionally, but it was becoming more common, was suddenly playing this complete blunder. So that's a possibility. And there's also, I guess, remembering all the openings, I think, is harder. Well, learning a new opening, an opening from scratch is harder, I think, after a certain age. And then a slightly more controversial one is motivation and whether you still have the same motivation as when you were younger. So I don't know. And again, I'll talk from my personal experience again now. Was when I was a junior player, if I had a match on Friday, then by Monday I'm already like, that's the only thing I'm thinking about in my whole week. You know, it's like, I've got this game coming up. I'm so excited for it. I need to learn what I'm playing. And then after the game, you know, for days, if I'd won the game, I'm happy for days. And if I've lost, then what have I done wrong? And whereas nowadays I can get to the next day and I I don't even remember whether I won or lost the game. It's like, you get over it quicker, but I think I still get annoyed if I lose, but I do get over it much quicker. Like something else will happen, and then it just kind of goes from my mind completely. And so each individual game, I think me and other players as well, you still want to win it, and you're still trying as hard, but it's not quite the be all and end all maybe that when you're younger. And I guess that you're not going to get quite as good results then. You may be more inclined to draw a game or whatever.
Well, that sounds like the motivation part, as you described it, sounds like it could go either way in terms of it being a benefit or a challenge. Because you're saying that, you know, people tend to be, as they get older, maybe a little less motivated to, I don't know, maybe to care, you know, with as much force as they used to about winning or losing a game. But it seems like sometimes that can be a benefit, know that you put less pressure on yourself. Is there a flip side to that, do you think?
Absolutely. So there is that, that you don't put the pressure on yourself. There's also another thing related to that, which is, do you calculate to the end of the line, or how much do you calculate and how much do you play the move you think is going to be the right move? And as you build up your experience, there'll be lines that there's no way you're going to sit and calculate it out. Whereas when you're a kid, you'll calculate, you know, advance your knight into g5 and then f6, you know, into some crazy part of the board where it shouldn't really be going, but you'd calculate it all out. And sometimes it would work and sometimes you'd get it to work. But once you've played a lot of chess, there's some lines you can kind of just rule out because you know it's not really a very plausible line that it'll work. It maybe it works, but it's not very plausible. And because chess, some positions you can calculate to the end of the line, but a lot of positions, even if you had half an hour to calculate that one move, you're still not going to definitively know in a complicated position. There's still lots going on, and you maybe can't calculate it. And I think as a older player, you can maybe assess that kind of position, and you can just say, well, look, I actually just want to play a good move. If there was a move that is slightly better, it doesn't really matter. Oh, one of my club mates, actually, he's got a very good saying for this. Because I don't know if you've heard the phrase, when you see a good move, look for a better one.
Yes, I have.
You've heard that, yeah. And so my friend at our club, his name's Roger Emerson, and he says, at senior level, when you see a good move, just be grateful. And so you can find a good move, just be grateful, just play your good move, keep your time, and just, you know, just play nice chess like that. Yeah.
That's great. I love it. So what were some of the strategies that you recommended in the book in terms of dealing with the challenges of getting older? And I imagine a lot of these ideas come from your experience in talking and interviewing with these players, but just as there were some maybe common challenges that they all raised, what were some of the common solutions that arose as you talked to them?
Actually, there was a question you were asking earlier about whether you play in senior events or not. And there's an interesting point came up because different players have different styles, and actually some styles are suited better to the senior events. So John Nunn, he plays a very combative style. He's like Sicilian, Neidorf Sicilian, and very sharp, very attacking chess. He more or less has stopped completely playing in open events or against the juniors, but he's world champion. He's world over 65 champion now at seniors. He's absolutely fantastic at senior level. And he can still play, you know, he can still play those same openings. He can still play exactly his natural style of very sharp chess, calculating things through, getting the advantage, delivering checkmate. He can just do that against the seniors. But he actually finds that a little bit more difficult, I think, when you against all ages. Compare that with Keith Arkell, who is the other. He's been a over 50 champion. His style of play is just the opposite. So he has these positional ideas that he knows really well, and he has been playing identical chess for 30 years. He plays a lot of chess, and he what he does is he like in the center of the board, he'll try, like, if he's white, he'll try and play c takes d5 e takes d5, so he'll basically swap off a c pawn for an e pawn, so he's got a majority of pawns on the king side, very safe king, and then tries to play this positional style where he makes the opponent's c and d pawns weak, and then just tries to win an endgame. And he's famous for playing a lot of rook and pawn endings. Now, he can play that against any age, because the junior players, like, typically anyway, the junior players wouldn't necessarily know their rook and pawn endings in detail and wouldn't really be that familiar with those positional themes. They're very, very good at calculating perhaps, but they don't know these themes. So Keith still plays against any age, whereas John, he just plays best at the seniors. And so they're both excelling, but sticking with their natural style of play. Because actually it's quite hard to radically change your style of play. Most people we saw did change their openings a little bit, especially if they were kind of E4 and and myself as well, E4 players and liked open games, then you do sometimes introduce English opening or knight F3 or a quieter start fianchettoing your bishops perhaps. So you kind of introduce quieter systems as well, and maybe you play a mixture of those. I mean, the really top players, obviously, they play any opening you like. But someone who has remained really, really strong is Michael Adams, Grandmaster Michael Adams. And he played in the over 50s, but he's just had such a good year. Like in 2023, he won the World Championship for seniors over 50. He won the British Championship of any age. He won the London Chess Classic, and he's just had such a good year. And he always sits at the board. He doesn't get up and wander around at all. He's very, very focused still. He was born in 1971, so he'd be 50, 52, I think. And he's just playing just exceptional chess still at that age. But he hasn't, I don't think he's particularly, he still plays E4 and stuff. He hasn't particularly, like, completely re-engineered his openings, but he's also someone who's had a very positional style and knows the right places for the pieces. So that kind of style, I think, does set you in good stead, even, you know, as a senior player.
Yeah, so you mentioned a couple of things that and I kind of want to relate it to something. So one is, I think you kind of started by talking about basically addressing the point of, does your style work for any type of age group that you're playing against? In one instance, the answer was yes. Of one example you cited, another, it was no. So perhaps knowing how your style works for different age groups. And you also talked about adjusting your opening potentially too. You know, a lot of the players in your book, they're, you know, just some of the best, or at least very, very accomplished chess players. And I'm curious how much of that, like, the lessons you learned from that still can or maybe doesn't apply to adult club level players, kind of in that, I don't know, maybe 12 to 1800 range. In other words, the suggestions you just gave that I identified, is that relevant at that level? Or is it more when you're kind of, I don't know, 1800, 2000 and beyond?
Yeah, so I suppose at the 1200 to 1800 level, I think maybe it's not, you're not going to lose the game just in the opening, I think, so much. You kind of, if someone wins a pawn or something, you still keep playing and you're still in the game, right?
Right.
So perhaps the openings is a bit less critical, and I think the same thing still happened though, right? You still, with experience, and if you've played more chess and whatever, then you can still get a good feeling for what's going to be a good move, what you need to calculate, and where you can rely on your judgment. So that still, I think, at that level is you can still kind of play what you think is a good move, if you rather than trying to calculate right to the end of the line in every circumstance. In terms of which tournaments you go to and whether you just stick to seniors, I think you're fine against juniors. It's actually nice. It's nice to play juniors, isn't it? As long as you're not too worried about your ELO rating. But it is lovely to play juniors. I think I sometimes I actually did a coaching at a school, and they invite me and they play this sort of three minute and 2 second blitz tournament against all the juniors, and it is really, really fun, but I never score that well.
You know what, if I could just ask a question about that, because I so rarely hear that. Most adults usually say the opposite, that they don't look forward to playing juniors. So I'm just curious, like, what do you enjoy about playing them?
I think so. You don't quite know. You never quite know how good they're going to be, right? Because yeah. they'll have, they might. You know, today actually, like in England at the moment, we've got such strong juniors. It's really lovely. Actually, there's been a few years, you know, 10 years ago or something, when it wasn't quite like that. But at the moment, we've got so many strong juniors, and I think it was all started from COVID and people took up chess around about that time, and the Queen's Gambit coming on Netflix. We've just got another chess boom, and they're so, so strong, and it's just lovely to follow them and see how well they're doing. So actually, I like play, from that point of view, I really like it, because if I play them when they're 7 years old, I do have a chance, right? I have a chance of beating them. And then if they're going to get really, really, really good, I can say, well, I've beaten that player, you know, and also, you don't know what they're going to know and what they're going to not know. So you have got it's like a game where you don't know what's going to happen, which I quite like that, where it's all you might just beat them out of the opening because they're not experienced in the particular opening, you know, which might be very different from the openings they play, because if you're playing one that was popular, you know, 20 years ago, they might not know. That you know, if they've just been playing against juniors, they might be used to other types of openings or other types of positional games. Now, of course, some of the things I'm saying is sort of vastly generalizing on how juniors play, and each junior plays in a different way.
That's okay.
But if there's sort of positional games that a senior player understands, they might be able to get the junior into position they're uncomfortable with and win that way. And then what happens, right? But then you might have this kind of positional bind, but then the junior might do tricks and play unexpected moves. So it's a lot of fun.
Well, I like that you embrace the sort of the unpredictability of playing with them. that's great. I'd love to just talk some about your Chessable courses that you've released recently. I know you're involved with three courses. I'd like to talk about your most recent two. Let's start with the course you released and co-authored last year in 2023, Zwischenzug, A Comprehensive Guide to Intermediate Moves. First of all, I think you've come up with fantastic ideas for your courses, and I think there's some things that we can discuss that I think a lot of my audience will be interested in learning about. So to start with that course, can we clarify the definition of an intermediate move for the audience? I think a lot of club players might be a little fuzzy on that. Is it always a tactic that wins material?
No. So how we're I guess there's no one hard and fast definition for it, but how we've defined it is a move that's not in the normal run of play. So it's and that you play this intermediate move in order to give yourself some kind of advantage. So as an example, if your queen's attacked, the normal instinctive move might be to move your queen away. But we're sort of training ourselves not to automatically do that. It might be that that's the best, is to move the queen away. But there might be another different move that you can play in between and get some kind of advantage by doing that. Another very common advantage is if a piece is captured. So normally a piece is captured, you recapture it. And if you watch a lot of online blitz or whatever, then they just go captures, recaptures, and takes. They say takes.
Right.
And sometimes if takes, then takes isn't the best move, and you can do something actually better in between. So they might take something, you maybe have a check, they move, and then you recapture, or something like that. And these kind of things, you can, what we like the idea of looking into those and seeing how you can get an advantage. And there's a whole lot of tactics that are in this category. So what we did was we looked for themes in this kind of position, because a lot of tactics books, they might have a page on Zwischenzugs, but we haven't seen anything which is a real study on Zwischenzugs on their own. So what we did, we looked in Chessbase, and you know how in Chessbase there's annotated games, and so we searched on all the annotations for the words Zwischenzug, intermezzo, intermediate move, and pulled out whole, you know, hundreds of games with that kind of annotation in it. We also, there is now an automated Zwischenzug search in Chessbase, and that pulls out anything which would be takes and then a different move and not takes and then coming back and doing the takes. So those are the automated ones, and then the annotated ones can be quite different. So it might be you're in an end game, the expected move is something, but you might attack the queen first, get the queen to move, and then play the move that would be the expected move. And then you can get an advantage because you've managed to deflect the queen to a worse square or whatever. So it can be to try and win material, but it can also be just getting a slight positional advantage, or maybe knocking one of your opponent's pieces out of the way so it can't defend things or it can't counterattack you. So there's sort of a whole variety of puzzles. But what we did was play through hundreds of examples, and then we noted down why it was a forcing move, so whether it was a check or a capture or whatever, but then also patterns that so it was things like if both sides' queens were on prees, and we put names to these things, so in mutual queens on prees, if both sides' queens are on prees and it's your move, there's very often a chance to play a clever tactic and to win material. So you might be able to move the queen out of the way and give a check, king has to move, and then you come back and take their queen. But it can be more complicated ones than that. You're often a desperado as well. So you give up your queen, but for something, you know, like a pawn, but you're winning a pawn out of the whole thing.
I see.
Yeah. We came up with lots of themes. There was a lovely one which we called connected queens or connected rooks or bishops. And so if you had like the two queens lined up and then say a knight in between, then there's often a tactic where you can move that knight out the way, they take your queen, then you move the knight again with a check, they have to move, and then you recapture, and you can get kind of win material or whatever with that. So we set out Awesome Eight, so eight different patterns, and named them, and saw that those were happening kind of again and again. So we didn't know what those patterns would be before we started the work. It was just we wrote them all out in a spreadsheet and looked at kind of which ones were commonly occurring. So there are other patterns that can occur in Zwischenzugs, but these were the ones that were happening again and again in master games. And so the whole idea is if we make people aware of those themes that keep happening, then they can look in their position and see if that theme is present, they know to look out for this kind of tactic. And it was really, really nice because there was one of these was a threat to promote. What happened was after playing through all of these, then I myself was looking out for these positional ideas. Matt, who I wrote the course with, he was also looking out for those ideas. And we kept finding them in our own games. And I got this lovely one in the seniors teams championship And the thing, like, it's quite exciting anyway, winning a game. But if you win it with a Zwischenzug tactic, I was like, so hyper. It was like, so I played this tactic, which he hadn't seen at all. It was complete shock to him. And then he just was like, thought about it for 5 or 10 minutes afterwards. He was losing material, and then he just resigned. And it was like, oh, but I, you know, like, I'm sure I wouldn't have spotted it had I not sort of done all that work on Zwischenzugs. And then the next championship, also last year, I had a Zwischenzug, a threatened checkmate one, which allowed me to get a piece out and get a good position. And I managed to beat a Fide master with it. So that was, it was just like really, really nice. But not only that, then we had people who'd studied the course were then starting to play Zwischenzugs in their own game. So one guy, Moritz van Meer, who's one of the chess punks.
Yeah, yeah, I know who he is.
Yeah, do you know? He'd kind of already before the tournament sort of tweeted about Zwischenzugs. And then in his first game, he played and he had this connector queen's position, managed to move his knight out of the way and take a piece and then get a check. And so he won a piece. And it was really, really nice. And so we've put it kind of in the book. We've put his position there that he'd got from studying the course, because he was just looking out for it once he had the connector queens.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I love that. I love hearing that he benefited that way, and all the ways that you benefited too from creating this course. One other question I had for you about this course is, maybe it's a bit of a, I don't know, bird's eye view, a broader scope kind of question, but it seems that there might be a benefit to studying intermediate moves even beyond being able to identify the patterns that you mentioned and you know, capitalizing on them. It strikes me that these intermediate moves is a more creative way of looking at the board, rather than just looking for the obvious direct moves as you kind of described. You're looking for something less obvious, something a little more hidden or subtle. Do you feel that studying intermediate moves kind of carries this benefit of seeing the game a little differently?
One thing was we'd written the course and you'd followed the Ding Nepo World Championship.
It was a little bit of a tough time for me health wise at that point, but yeah, okay. I followed it somewhat. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we'd just finished writing the course at that point, and we'd identified these themes and outcomes and all this stuff. And then the Ding Nepo match came on, and we'd basically finished. We were about to submit to Chessable. And then the style of this match, you might have seen commentary, and people were saying, oh, they're not playing the top engine choices all the time. They're making mistakes and various things, but it was very creative play. And within that match, there were a lot of Zwischenzugs. And following it, we found Zwischenzugs of every single pattern that was in our course and every single outcome. And there were just so many. And so we decided we'd have to write an extra chapter about this Ding Tometso match. Ding Tometso was our chapter because it's Ding and Intermezzo, Ding Tometso. so we added this chapter. But it was very exciting to watch. But that style of play, it wasn't an accident. So about two-thirds of the Zwischenzugs in the match were played by Ding. And we don't think it's any accident that he played so many. Because, okay, the play wasn't like mega, mega accurate compared with some of the other players and the more positional play. But what he did was kind of inject this, I'm going to use the word, we use it in the course, it's a Japanese word called aji. It's a word they use a lot for Go players use it. And what you do is you kind of put, Go's played with stones, you put a stone in the middle of their position and just to give possibilities for later. So it's not that you've got a tactic then and there, but if you can inject these things into the position where it's going to be favourable to you, or it's potentially going to be favourable to you later. So for example, you might be giving them a weak pawn or weak pawn structure or something like that, or giving them a weak king, or they've got pieces that, you know, like the phrase loose pieces drop off, if they've got loose pieces, Or if you've got maybe like a queen and bishop lined up on a diagonal, or, you know, you've got a strong diagonal and you could potentially unblock it by moving a pawn, all these kind of things. So you've got potential in your position, then any kind of position like that where there's a lot going on, then there's lots more possibility for Zwischenzugs. And because there's like possibilities of tactics. And so if the normal move is takes and captures, recaptures or something, then you look at, you know, if you've got this position where there's lots of stuff going on, that you might be able to play just a different surprising move. And so by studying these, it's, yes, you're becoming aware of what the tactical sequences are, but you're also becoming aware of the types of position where they occur. And so you can kind of aim for those positions which are going to get tactics in your favor. And the other thing is, we've got in the book of Zwischenzug, which is coming out very, very soon, we've got Mickey Adams to write the foreword. And what he commented was also that a lot of high level chess is about containing what your opponent can do. So you also need to be aware, say there's a move you want to play, but there's tactics. Quite a lot of it is the calculation, but can you still play that move even despite the tactic? Can, you know, if you played it anyway, can you get it to work? And we had a lot of ones in that book about putting a rook to the open file, and it looks like it's, you're allowing a tactic, but actually, because it's such a good, you've put your rook to such a good position, you can, the tactics somehow work for you. And he was saying it's about sort of defending, you know, becoming aware of when the Zwischenzugs are in the position, so you can also defend against your opponent's ones, and you're aware of if that's going to happen to you as well. So it's sort of attacking and defensive, but also long-term play, just putting the right factors into the position so that you might get them later. So I do think, and also the patterns we're highlighting, they work for Zwischenzugs. They also are sort of work for normal tactics, you know, like discovered attacks and forks and pins and that sort of thing as well. So you become a bit sharper in all those tactics, and that is like building on those tactics. Because Zwischenzugs is based on those building blocks, but it's a little more involved because you play an intermediate move and then you're coming back to kind of finish off the original tactic, if you see what I mean.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I love that. I love that it has kind of this broader reach benefit to learning them. That's fantastic. And, you know, the other course I want to talk about with you that you created recently, and this year it was released, is Learn to Counterattack, an yes. Essential Guide to Active Defense. So, and that's another course you did co-presented with Matt Bell. What appealed to you about this topic, especially when most folks are focused on attacking?
Yeah. So this course was authored by Lithuanian, she's English now, but Lithuanian international master, Dagnė Čiukšytė. And she wanted to do counterattacking. And she'd read our Zwischenzug course and wanted us to present. And they actually relate very well together.
I noticed that. I'd love to talk about that. Sorry. Yeah.
So it's kind of like if you're being attacked, then what Dagnė had always been taught, she went to a chess school, actually, and what she was always taught was to first of all look for the active move. So before you start anything, don't think about how you defend against their attack. First of all, look for the active move, because if there's an active move, or if you can attack, you can take the initiative away from your opponent, and that the process of doing that can often defend for you. And so she was like coaching some junior players, and there was one particular junior player she was coaching who, if they were attacked, they'd always come backwards and retreat. And they were like a strong player, but they found they were like getting kind of pushed around because they would be retreating, and then their opponent would have much more possibilities. And I suppose, I don't know, when you first start to play, it kind of feels rude that if you're attacked, you know, you have to do something about it. You can't just go and do something else and ignore it, can you? Right. But she was, yeah, wanting to train her coachee to actually think about going forwards and playing this active move. So it does tie in quite a lot, actually, with Fischer-Zugs because, you know, when we were saying our definition is not to play the sort of instinctive first move that you're taught to play. So if you're attacked, maybe your first instinct is, I'm going to defend. But actually, this counterattacking is to kind of try and counter that instinct and instead look for the active move. Now, it might be the active move doesn't work. And we've got examples in the course of where actually playing the counterattacking move isn't the right thing to do. But quite a lot of the time it is. And if you play this active move, you're forcing your opponent to think about your threats. And so they don't have time to continue their attack. Obviously, you have to calculate it all out. But if you can get your attack going faster than theirs, then you can kind of turn around a game that might have been looking promising for them. And we've got some lovely games in there as well. We've done so there's tactics. Some of them are Zwischenzugs, and they're like, it can be that the opponent's trying to checkmate you, and instead you deliver checkmate on them. The courses for is probably we'd think of it more as a prequel to Zwischenzug because there's more basic tactics. It does go to it sort of starts with basic and then goes on to quite advanced tactics. But we also included full games of master games with counterattacks. And there was this very nice one by Max Erva, who was only about 20 moves long, and it looked like that white was coming in and they'd taken on h7 and the king was in all sorts of trouble, and then Erva just sacrificed a rook for absolutely nothing, but then it managed to get his other rook right onto the seventh rank and actually set up mating threats against the opponent's king, and actually he ended up winning very, very quickly because actually when you do these counterattacks it can be a surprise to the opponent, and in that particular game, the annotator was saying Erva's opponent suddenly just completely was on a bit of tilt afterwards and didn't play the best moves after that. So, and then we also have games. There was a game by junior player Michelle, and she gave up both her rooks and then managed to deliver mate. So there's a sort of mixture from top grandmaster to junior player and club games.
Yeah, that doesn't happen too often. That's exciting. So, a question for you about the concept of counterattacking as a form of defense. Because I think for a lot of club players especially, like the default is if you're being attacked, you look for a way to defend against the attack. But, you know, if you were given a choice to just strictly defend versus defending with an attack, it seems like the latter would be much more desirable. So, given that if you can defend through counterattacking, if it's there, is that the first way that you should look at your defense?
That's the first way to look, yeah. Look for the active move first and then see if it works. And so, you know, it could be... And you kind of build up experience of when it might work and when you can get threats. So you need a threat that's big enough... that is going to be bigger than their attack on you. So quite often a counterattack is going to be against the opposing king, a check or a checkmating threat, because those attacks, then they really have to defend against them. There are some in the course which are like trapping the queen, a surprising trap of the queen, or doing a fork. There's also actually a very interesting one about taking control of the centre. So just giving up material, but in order to get control of the centre and reduce the scope of the opponent's pieces. And so counterattacking, it can be, again, it's a bit like Zwischenzugs, it can be that you've calculated the whole sequence, come up to a checkmate or come up to a forced win of material. But it can be a little bit more positional. so that you just have better chances in that position. So you might have given up, say you've given up the exchange or something, and restricted their pieces. And there's a game of Dagnes that where she does that. And she just felt like if she played the sort of standard move, she just looked at the position and thought it was very, very passive. She was playing against a grandmaster and it was just, she didn't like that position. So actually she didn't know that she would win necessarily by playing this counter-attacking move, but she knew she had to try it just in order to get a sort of nicer type of position. And again, and this one's down to style as well, right? Because some players actually don't mind defending and defending, whereas other players, they really just much prefer to be the one making the threats and the one doing the active play. And so you can, sometimes it's worth a little bit of material to make sure you're the one in the position that has the chances and are kind of calling the shots.
Yeah, so I'd like to just kind of finish our discussion and chat, Natasha, with a handful of just fun, more lighthearted questions that I now close my interviews with. But I loved everything we've talked about so far. And I just want to mention that, you know, I've looked through each of your Chessable courses and they just seem fantastic. They really do. Yeah, I just really love that you, you know, just chose different types of topics for the courses that you wanted to present and teach. And I think they're really valuable. They're subjects that are just less often discussed, but still very important. And I appreciate that. So I definitely encourage people to check out your course as well. I have links to them in the show notes and on my website for this episode. So yeah, on to just some handful of fun questions now for you, Natasha, to finish our discussion. First one for you, who is your favorite player of all time?
In terms of games, I really liked playing through the games of Bobby Fischer. I liked the open style of play. And I had the book, My 60 Memorable Games, when I was a child. And I used to play through those games again and again. And just like the way he could sort of get an advantage with what looked like simple moves and then sort of turn it into checkmate. And there's this really nice game that we had in the Zwischens, of course, actually, which was his game against Donald Byrne, and it was called the Game of the Century at the time. And he kind of gave up his queen, did rook check, and then brought his bishop and knight in. And he was only a teenager at the time he played this game, but it's just like really, really nice.
That's great. I love it. Yeah, I have a soft spot for his games as well, because when I was a kid and adolescent learning and getting excited about chess for the first time, his games were the ones that I studied first. So I always have that memory with him. If you could play a great player of the past who is no longer alive, who would it be?
I think I would be very intrigued to play Vera Menchik, who is the first women's world champion. She there's actually been a tournament in England just last week, which was a Vera Menchik memorial tournament, and it makes us remember her. She actually died really young in the war, and she was, I think, 38 or something like that. But she had she was playing against all the great men players of the time and beating loads of them. Very strong player, and it'd be absolutely fascinating to play against her.
Yeah, great choice. If you could play any of the top players in the world right now, who would it be?
Well, now that one, I would play that. I play actually some doubles chess, which is where you have a partner and then you play against a partner. And I was very, very lucky to play in this event against Hikaru Nakamura and a partner. So it was and Michael Adams against Hikaru and his partner. And we actually, me and Mickey actually managed to win this game. So we were very happy. But it was lovely to play against him, because before the game started, we had a little conversation about Go, and he also plays Go as well as chess. But Hikaru, I watch some of his streams, but I like his style of play because he, like in tricky positions, he can kind of conjure up these amazing tactics. It's really great fun to play against him.
Yeah, I love his style of play as well. Your favorite opening as white?
Nowadays, the Reti. I like with knight f3 and a nice quiet opening. That's my favorite. I used to always play e4 and King's Gambits and all this sort of thing, but I've had too many tricky experiences with the King's Gambit, although I do always have fun if I reel it out again just on occasion.
That's great. Your favorite opening as black?
This one I don't play very much anymore. I used to play it as my main opening all the time, which was the Alekhine's Defense. And I used to love it. I used to know all the moves before engines and all that sort of stuff. And it was just so nice because you'd move your knight all across the board. They'd get a big center. But then quite often you could like dismantle the center and win a pawn in the center and get a nice end game. So I used to really enjoy that.
That's great. I've decided to ask you a more timely question. Is there a player in the candidates tournament that's coming up in just several weeks that you're hoping will win? Not necessarily based on skill per se, but just a personal favorite.
Yes. Gukesh, I want to win. He was in London last year at the Chess Classic, and I chatted with him, and he's just really, really nice. So I would definitely want him to win.
Oh, that's fantastic. I love that you had a chance to meet him as well. That's great.
He was just happy to chat. Yeah.
That's great. So my last question for you, if a chess genie existed and can grant you any one chess wish, what would you wish for?
Yeah, so I think now because I play lots of different games as well as chess, and I think what I would like to do if I change chess a bit is have tournaments, maybe like potentially Fischer Random or, you know, Chess 960 or that kind of thing where it's like chess, but not exactly chess. So I play Japanese chess, which is called shogi. It's a lovely, wonderful game. But to have tournaments that are a mixture of games, perhaps. Or it could be like some rounds chess, some shogi, some, you know, just like mix it up a bit. So it's less reliant just on opening theory and more you're kind of in a position and you're working it all out for yourself each time.
That's great. I love that answer. I have not heard someone give that answer before, but I love it. I think it's really interesting. I can understand wanting a little less emphasis on opening theory. So, Natasha, I just had a really enjoyable time listening to everything that you had to share and all your knowledge and insights. You've had an amazing chess career. I wish I had another hour to discuss other parts of it, but we hit on a lot of highlights. And I just appreciate everything that you're doing for the chess community with your courses. And I think just the fact that you are, you know, just regularly playing, regularly competing is inspiring and motivating to fellow adult improvers like myself and those who listen to the show. So thank you so much for being on here.
Thank you so much. Thank you for the chance to come on your show.
Thanks for listening. This has been a production of my business, Adult Chess Academy. And that has a website with the same name if you want to look for it. You can also find me being way too active on Twitter by searching my username, Lona_chess. See you next week.